Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 135, American Apartheid, Part 1. Powerful book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander, with a foreword by Cornel West. Published by The New Press. Chapters are, number one, The Rebirth of Caste, two, The Lockdown, three, The Color of Justice, four, The Cruel Hand, five, The New Jim Crow, six, After James Baldwin, The Fire This Time. Powerful look at what's going on, connection with the current news of the Black Lives Matter movement, and all lives matter, really. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. I'm about four-fifths of the way through a powerful book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander, with foreword by Cornel West. And a rare thing for me to read a book on the New York Times bestseller list. It's, I don't know if it's, you can compare, but it's as equally as damning as Ilan Pop's book on Israel and Palestine, when you get right down to the deliberateness of the system. Some of the first impressions are, especially coming off the six-part series on the native peoples, where the natives have been put on the reservations. The blacks or African Americans, however you prefer, have been put incarcerations, and the ghettos and sort of have these minorities where the system is sort of pseudo-quarantining or putting them in zones that are essentially, though not that much as much now with the environmental activism and the Black Lives Matter movement, still sort of, for a lot of people, out of sight, out of mind. And even though I had read many articles and seen Eugene Jarecki's documentary, The House We Live In, I think it's called, or The House I Live In, and I'm familiar with Stop and Frisk and all this other stuff that tells a lot, but to see it, to put in a book, it just somehow for me, it emphasizes the point and really has a sort of convincing thing. I find that time and again in reading a book. She uses phrases such as the caste system, the racial caste system, the criminal justice system. The book shows the, again, not just that there is minorities predominantly, the blacks are put in the prisons, but the way the whole system works judicially, economically, socio-politically. One of the biggest things is after getting out of jail, even on minor offenses or whatever they are called, having to check the box, section on that about checking the box felon, then affects going for a job, going for housing. So what seems like a inoffensive offense of being a minor prison sentence for maybe drugs or something, in effect the system is branding these people and then making it difficult for them to even participate in the mainstream system with basic necessities such as jobs, educations, etc. So that's the kind of overview. It just has a lot to do with the labor force, the plantation, the plantation elite mentality that's going on, the control of the populations. One of the strategies mentioned earlier on, even years and years ago, I think before the civil rights time, was this, when the was that the system used the poor, they rewarded the poor whites as a way to divide and conquer, so that they kind of lifted the poor whites up a bit to help avoid the black, becoming sort of communist or gaining their power, or perhaps the poor whites and blacks joining together. I'm not sure. We'll see as we get into this. Not sure how many parts. Again, this could be a long part, as the Deloria book was, but attempt to keep it a bit more concise. Brief foreword by Cornel West, who, if you don't know him, check him out online. His videos, I haven't read his books, but a phenomenal person and persona and author, speaker, what have you. And here's Cornel in the foreword, her referring to the Michelle Alexander, her subtle analysis shifts our attention from the racial symbol of America's achievement to the actual substance of America's shame, the massive use of state power to incarcerate hundreds of thousands of precious poor black, male, and increasingly female young people in the name of a bogus war on drugs. In her nuanced historical narrative tracing the unconscionable treatment and brutal control of black people, slavery, Jim Crow, mass incarceration, takes us beneath the political surfaces and lays bare the structures of a racial caste system alive and well in the age of color blindness. The new Jim Crow, then he goes on, the new Jim Crow shatters this silence. Once you read it, you have crossed the Rubicon and there is no return to sleepwalking. You are now awakened to a dark and ugly reality that has been in place for decades and that is continuous with the racist underside of American history from the advent of slavery onward. There is no doubt that if young white people were incarcerated at the same rates as young black people, the issue would be a national emergency. And in her introduction, Michelle Alexander highlights, rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color, quote, criminals, unquote, and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. So that's a recurring note in the book, that it's an the racism is now unspoken. So whether some of the specifics can be quoted in here, the getting into the way the system works, but you know, someone can be locked up for the drug offense, for this offense, for that offense, but the racism card is never really, you know, allowed, spoken, and so that's part of why we, in many ways, we think we've evolved, and perhaps in a broad spectrum of culture, in some ways, yes, but in many ways, no. As she writes, we have not ended racial caste in America, we have merely redesigned it. The drug war is the new Jim Crow. The drug war is the main tool. A few years after the drug war was declared, crack began to spread rapidly in the poor black neighborhoods of Los Angeles and later emerged in cities across the country. President Ronald Reagan officially announced the current drug war in 1982, before crack became an issue in the media or a crisis in poor black neighborhoods. A few years later, after the drug war was declared, crack began to spread rapidly in the poor black neighborhoods of Los Angeles and later emerged in cities across the country. So there is the theory that, you know, that the drugs were actually pumped into the neighborhoods, in part, or however you look at it, by the government. The media bonanza surrounding the new demon drug helped to catapult the war on drugs from an ambitious federal policy to an actual war. The CIA admitted in 1998 that guerrilla armies it actively supported in Nicaragua were smuggling illegal drugs into the United States, drugs that were making their way onto the streets of inner-city black neighborhoods in the form of crack cocaine. The CIA also admitted that in the midst of the war on drugs, it blocked law enforcement efforts to investigate illegal drug networks that were helping to fund its covert war in Nicaragua. And that's prefaced by, though difficult to accept, that is the concept. While the conspiracy theories were initially dismissed as far-fetched, if not downright loony, the word on the street turned out to be right, at least to a point. Bears emphasis that the CIA never admitted, nor has any evidence been revealed to support the claim, that it intentionally sought the destruction of the black community by allowing illegal drugs to be smuggled into the U.S. Nonetheless, conspiracy theorists surely must be forgiven for their bold accusation of genocide in light of the devastation wrought by crack cocaine and drug war, and the odd coincidence that an illegal drug crisis suddenly appeared in the black community after, not before, a drug war had been declared. In fact, the war on drugs began at a time when illegal drug use was on the decline. I read that aloud at a poetry reading, and I could just see and feel the head turns. I'll read that again. In fact, the war on drugs began at a time when illegal drug use was on the decline. The impact of the drug war has been astounding. In less than 30 years, the U.S. penal population exploded from around 300,000 to more than 2 million, with drug convictions accounting for the majority of the increase. The U.S. now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of nearly every developed country, even surpassing those in highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, and Iran. In Germany, 93 people are in prison for every 100,000 adults and children. In the U.S., the rate is roughly 8 times that, or 750 per 100,000. Governments use punishment primarily as a tool of social control, she writes. Again, another overriding theme that I found is, sort of on the basis of crime, that people sort of, you know, it gets promoted as, you know, even with the stop and frisks in New York City, though a small percentage, doing the Bloomberg mayoral whatever, a small percentage was, say, finding guns, and small percentage is sort of relative to lives type of thing, but I think it was like less than 1% or 1% of stops finding guns or solving a crime. So it's under this premise of crime fighting, and you get the media and the news, most local news and papers and TV, they're going to show you the photo of the black person. It's sort of instilled in the society that the minorities and blacks are the criminals, and the white collar crime doesn't, you know, gets reported in a sort of clean way, if at all. So you have this whole cultural premise upon which this whole system is running. So again, she's gonna, as she gets on in the book, to describe the differences, because they're not just replicas, but there's obviously similarities and differences. Slavery, Jim Crow, mass incarceration. And here's her thesis. What this book is intended to do, the only thing is intended to do, is to stimulate a much-needed conversation about the role of the criminal justice system in creating and perpetuating racial hierarchy in the U.S. The fates of millions of people, indeed the future of the black community itself, may depend on the willingness of those who care about racial justice to re-examine their basic assumptions about the role of the criminal justice system in our society. The fact that more than half of the young black men in many large American cities are currently under the control of the criminal justice system or saddled with criminal records is not, as many argue, just a symptom of poverty or poor choices, but rather evidence of a new racial caste system at work. And she gives numerous references to where certain lower courts made decisions in favor of the minorities and blacks, but then I mean, I have to get to the specifics to show, but the reasonings given were just pure insanity and twisted logic that the Supreme Court was giving for the overturning of some of these laws. And she's describing one of the differences, most significantly the fact that mass incarceration is designed to warehouse a population deemed disposable, unnecessary to the functioning of the new global economy, while earlier systems of control were designed to exploit and control black labor. So I guess, you know, there's a comparison with the offshoring and the workers that, you know, at one time there the work was essential to help run the capital M machine, but nowadays with outsourcing and other things going on, it's not so much the using for labor, even though some of the labor in prison is used by corporations for, you know, paying dirt wages, penny wages, no offense, dirt. There's a key difference in the way the world has changed. Here she's talking about what can bring about change, but unless the public consensus supporting the current system is completely overturned, the basic structure of the new caste system will remain intact. Building a broad-based social movement, however, is not enough. It is not nearly enough to persuade mainstream voters that we have relied too heavily on incarceration or that drug abuse is a public health problem, not a crime. If the movement that emerges to challenge mass incarceration fails to confront squarely the critical role of race in the basic structure of society, and if it fails to cultivate an ethic of genuine care, compassion, and concern for every human being of every class, race, and nationality within our nation's borders, including poor whites who are often pitted against poor peoples of color, the collapse of mass incarceration will not mean the death of racial caste in America. I'm going to read that again because there's so much going on there, but it also reminds me of another overall theme in the book is how the system is essentially punitive and not rehabilitative, and the levels of minor fines and punishments that are placed upon these minorities who can barely afford things, and even coming out of jail and having to pay certain fines, the difference between them and the stereotypical whites, suburban whites, who are doing as much, if not more, drugs and not getting penalized, that is another major social theme in the book. Read that section, this bit again. It is not nearly enough to persuade mainstream voters that we have relied too heavily on incarceration or that drug abuse is a public health problem, not a crime. If the movement that emerges to challenge mass incarceration fails to confront squarely the critical role of race in the basic structure of our society, and if it fails to cultivate an ethic of genuine care, compassion, and concern for every human being of every class, race, and nationality within our nation's borders, including poor whites who are often pitted against poor people of color, the collapse of mass incarceration will not mean the death of racial caste in America. So I found her call for genuine care, compassion, and concern essential, because, you know, it's just so much gets kind of cold in the news reporting. And ending her introduction, inevitably a new system of racialized social control will emerge, one that we cannot foresee, just as the current system of mass incarceration was not predicted by anyone 30 years ago. No task is more urgent for racial justice advocates today than ensuring that America's current racial caste system is its last. Chapter 1 is the rebirth of caste. And I guess you could say, ironically, the seeds of the new system of control, mass incarceration, were planted during the civil rights movement itself, when it became clear that the old caste system was crumbling and a new one would have to take its place. Yeah, that just, you know, shows the sort of deliberateness of it all. The growing demand for labor on plantations was met through slavery. American Indians were considered unsuitable as slaves, largely because native tribes were clearly in a position to fight back. The fear of raids by Indian tribes led plantation owners to grasp for an alternative source of free labor. European immigrants were also deemed poor candidates for slavery, not because of their race, but rather because they were in short supply, and enslavement would quite naturally interfere with voluntary immigration to the new colonies. Plantation owners thus viewed Africans, who were relatively powerless, as the ideal slaves. The systematic enslavement of Africans and the rearing of their children under bondage emerged with all deliberate speed, quickened by events such as Bacon's Rebellion. And just sort of reading little bits as I leaf through here. Under the terms of our country's founding documents, slaves were defined as 3/5 of a man, not a real whole human being. Upon this racist fiction rests the entire structure of American democracy. And I would add the doctrine of Christian discovery, and those two, that right there makes the 1-2 wallop. And further on, ultimately the black codes were overturned and a slew of federal civil rights legislation protecting the newly freed slaves was passed during the relatively brief but extraordinary period of black advancement known as the Reconstruction Era. The impressive legislative achievements of this period include the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 bestowing full citizenship upon African Americans, the 14th Amendment prohibiting states from denying citizens due process and equal protection of the laws, the 15th Amendment providing that the right to vote should not be denied on account of race, and the Ku Klux Klan Acts, which, among other things, declared interference with voting a federal offense and the violent infringement of civil rights a crime. And then fast forward, we've seen Craig Pallas reports of the voting scandals and removing names from voting lists and redesigning districts to affect the voting. So again, even though these things are not officially spoken and though there are laws on the books, the same problems have morphed into the modern system. And again, the divide and rule segregation laws were proposed as part of a deliberate effort to drive a wedge between poor whites and African Americans. These discriminatory barriers were designed to encourage lower class whites to retain a sense of superiority over blacks, making it far less likely that they would sustain interracial political alliances aimed at toppling the white elite. So interesting to read that in light of today, where that barrier seems to be much harder to control, whether it's the natives and non-natives, or as is emerging, environmental and GMO type protests are more people across the board. And I think with YouTube and the phones and videos and you know, even though it's called Black Lives Matter, I think there are more non-blacks, whatever the phrase, that are realizing what's going on. Yeah, let's see, this Reconstruction Era is typically from 1863, when the North freed the slaves, to 1877, going and abandoned them and withdrew federal troops from the South. And here she highlights an interesting bit about the Civil Rights Movement. As the Civil Rights Movement began to evolve into a poor people's movement, it promised to address not only black poverty, but white poverty as well, thus raising the specter of a poor and working class movement that cut across racial lines. Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders made it clear that they viewed the eradication of economic equality as the next front in the human rights movement and made great efforts to build multiracial coalitions that sought economic justice. Shortly before his assassination, he envisioned bringing to Washington, D.C., thousands of the nation's disadvantaged in an interracial alliance and embraced rural and ghetto blacks, Appalachian whites, Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, and Native Americans to demand jobs and income, the right to live. History reveals that the seeds of the new system of control were planted well before the end of the civil rights movement. As Vanessa Barker describes in The Politics of Imprisonment, black activists in Harlem, alarmed by rising crime rates, actively campaigned for what would become the notorious Rockefeller drug laws, as well as other harsh sentencing measures. Wittingly or unwittingly, they found themselves complicit in the emergence of a penal system unprecedented in world history. So here you have the sort of struggles within the black community, black support for harsh responses to urban crime, support born of desperation and legitimate concern over the unraveling of basic security in inner city communities, helped provide political cover for conservative politicians who saw an opening to turn back the clock on racial progress in the U.S. So, you know, it's there are these gray areas to the topic, similarly as with the natives and non-natives and the government. As the rules of acceptable discourse changed, however, segregationists distanced themselves from an explicitly racist agenda. They developed instead the racially sanitized rhetoric of, quote, cracking down on crime, end quote, rhetoric that is now used freely by politicians of every stripe. After the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the public debate shifted focus from segregation to crime. And as the fear card has been played throughout much of the political history, here it is mentioned again, having to do with the appealing, trying to get the time period here, I think it's around the 60s, appealing to racial fears and antagonisms was central to this strategy. Though it had to be done surreptitiously, H.R. Haldeman, one of Nixon's key advisors, recalls that Nixon himself deliberately pursued a southern racial strategy. He, Nixon, emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. And, you know, going after the racist voters and such like. This is along with Ehrlichman, and again ties into Sheldon Wolin's inverted totalitarianism. So even Nixon, who did a lot of stuff during this period, Nixon called for a, quote, war on drugs, an announcement that proved largely rhetorical, as he declared illegal drugs public enemy number one without proposing dramatic shifts in drug policy. A backlash against blacks was clearly enforced, but no consensus had yet been reached regarding what racial and social order would ultimately emerge from these turbulent times. Then you get into, you know, the Reagan era, and Nancy just say no. Here I have a note, the opposite of reality. Reagan portrayed the criminal as a staring face, a face that belongs to a frightening reality of our time, the face of the human predator. That's the opposite of reality there. Who's the real predator? Reagan's racially coded rhetoric and strategy proved extraordinarily effective, as 22% of all Democrats defected from the party to vote for Reagan. The defection rate shot up to 34% among those Democrats who believed civil rights leaders were pushing too fast. October 1982, President Reagan officially announced his administration's war on drugs. At the time, he declared this new war. Less than 2% of the American public viewed drugs as the most important issue facing the nation. The fact was no deterrent to Reagan, for the drug war from the outset had little to do with public concern about drugs and much to do with public concern about race. Waging a war on drug users and dealers, Reagan made good on his promise to crack down on the racially defined others, the undeserving. Practically overnight, the budgets of federal law enforcement agencies soared. Between 1980 and 84, FBI anti-drug funding increased from $8 million to $95 million. Department of Defense anti-drug allocations increased from $33 million in 1981 to $1,042 million in 1991. During that same period, DEA, DEA anti-drug spending grew from $86 to $1,026 million, and FBI anti-drug allocations grew from $38 to $181 million. By contrast, funding agencies responsible for drug treatment, prevention, and education was dramatically reduced. The budget of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, for example, was reduced from $274 million to $57 million. Determined to ensure that the New Republic majority would continue to support the extraordinary expansion of the federal government's law enforcement activities and that Congress would continue to fund it, the Reagan administration launched a media offensive to justify the war on drugs. Central to the media campaign was an effort to sensationalize the emergence of crack cocaine to inner-city neighborhoods. Communities devastated by deindustrialization and skyrocketing unemployment, the media frenzy the campaign inspired simply could not have come at a worse time for African Americans. And this is also talking about the shift from the industrial economy to a service economy. So again, the use of workers has shifted, and it's all very reminiscent of the global war on of terror that the huge network now of departments and funding that has come on the heels of the Islamophobia. And similarly with the blacks and the natives, as far as the reservations and the distance, the new manufacturing jobs that opened during this time period, he's talking about 1987, were generally located in the suburbs. The growing spatial mismatch, and this tying into Deloria's view of the connection with land and space, had profound impact on African Americans trapped in ghettos. A study of urban black fathers found that only 28% had access to an automobile. The rate fell to 18% for those living in ghetto areas. Crack hit the streets in 1985, a few years after Reagan's drug war was announced. Joblessness and crack swept inner cities precisely at the moment that a fierce backlash against the civil rights movement was manifesting itself through the war on drugs. Interestingly, again, the global war on terror, even though much terror is produced because of the war. Here, similarly, a war on drugs when at first there were not the drugs to justify it. And then that the large percentage of blacks are imprisoned for minor drug offenses, typically harmless. There are serious issues going on, but the general statistics presented show that it's, a lot of minor harmless offenses, so it's in effect a war of drugs. And here she cites Portugal. Portugal, for example, responded to persistent problems of drug addiction and abuse by decriminalizing the possession of all drugs and redirecting the money that would have been spent putting drug users in cages into drug treatment and prevention. 10 years later, Portugal reported that rates of drug abuse and addiction had plummeted and drug-related crime was on the decline as well. Again, you have a punitive system. Or where can we talk about the rehabilitation, which is why this book is important. A bunch more pages, and this will give a good introduction in the chapter one, in what again looks to be a multi-part series to cover this fascinating, important, and lots of factoid topic. War on drugs, cloaked in race-neutral language, offered whites opposed to racial reform a unique opportunity to express their hostility toward blacks and black progress without being exposed to the charge of racism. In August 1989, President Bush characterized drug use as, quote, the most pressing problem facing the nation, end quote. Shortly thereafter, a New York Times CBS News poll reported that 64% of those polled, the highest percentage ever recorded, now thought that drugs were the most significant problem in the U.S. This surge of public concern did not correspond to a dramatic shift in illegal drug activity, but instead was the product of a carefully orchestrated political campaign. The level of public concern about crime and drugs was only weakly correlated with actual crime rates, but highly correlated with political initiatives, campaigns, and partisan appeals. Manufactured consent. The shift to a general attitude of toughness toward problems associated with communities of color began in the 1960s when the gains and goals of the civil rights movement began to require real sacrifices on the part of white Americans. And there you get into the sort of, and conservative politicians found they could mobilize white racial resentment by vowing to crack down on crime. That's where the line in the sand gets drawn often socioculturally in this sort of subtle elitist, you know, white attitude of and tying into the much of the commercial purchasing of the manufactured consent of the line in the white sand when it comes to actual changes. And here's the results were immediate. As law enforcement budgets exploded, so did prison and jail populations. 1991, the Sentencing Project reported that the number of people behind bars in the U.S. was unprecedented in world history, and that 1/4 of young African-American men were now under the control of the criminal justice system. Despite the jaw-dropping impact of the Get Tough movement on the African-American community, neither the Democrats nor Republicans revealed any inclination to slow down the pace of incarceration. As the Justice Policy Institute has observed, the Clinton administration's tough-on-crime policies resulted in the largest increases in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history. And a bit farther on, similarly, funding that had once been used for public housing was being redirected to prison construction. Instead of housing and education, we get this other angle. During Clinton's tenure, Washington slashed funding for public housing by $17 billion, a reduction of 61%, and boosted corrections by $19 billion, an increase of 171%, effectively making the construction of prisons the nation's main housing program for the urban poor. And the voice, the tone in my voice, rose to match the hypocrisy of that statement and that statistic. Clinton did not stop there. Determined to prove how tough he could be on them, Clinton also made it easier for federally assisted public housing projects to exclude anyone with a criminal history, an extraordinarily harsh step in the midst of a drug war aimed at racial and ethnic minorities. In his announcement of the One Strike and You're Out initiative, Clinton explained, from now on, the rule for residents who commit crime and peddle drugs should be one strike and you're out. That's disgusting when you consider the not one banker has gone to jail for essentially, you know, not trashing the economic system, but certainly not fixing it and perpetuating it. And wrapping up this chapter, thus for the countless poor people, particularly racial minorities, targeted by the drug war, public housing was no longer available, leaving many of them homeless, locked out not only of mainstream society, but their own homes. The law and order perspective, first introduced during the peak of the civil rights movement by rabid segregationists, had become nearly hegemonic 2 decades later. By the mid-1990s, no serious alternative to the war on drugs and Get Tough movements were being entertained in mainstream political discourse. Once again, in response to major disruption in the prevailing racial order, this time the civil rights gains of the 1960s, a new system of racialized social control was created by exploiting the vulnerabilities and racial resentments of poor and working-class whites. More than 2 million people found themselves behind bars in the turn of the 21st century, and millions more were relegated to the margin of mainstream society, banished to a political and social space not unlike Jim Crow, where discrimination in employment, housing, and access to education was perfectly legal and where they could be denied the right to vote. The system functioned relatively automatically, and the prevailing system of racial meanings, identities, and ideologies already seemed natural. 90% of those admitted to prison for drug offenses in many states were black or Latino, yet the mass incarceration of communities of color was explained in race-neutral terms, an adaptation to the needs and demands of the current political climate. The new Jim Crow was born. So that'll wrap it up for part one. Thanks for listening. Have a good one. Yeah, we'll go out with a powerful song. If you can check out the YouTube video, it's worth a listen. Watch. It's about 5 minutes. 1991, Public Enemy, Can't Trust It, is what it sounds like, but it's printed as T-R-U-S-S, Can't Trust It.
They started the slave ships.
Wait a few. There are more records of slave ships than one would dream. It seems inconceivable. Until you reflect that for 200 years, ships sailed carrying cargo of slaves.
Well, non-violent. In the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years, is actually doing our people a disservice. And back. It's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
Because of that, now I get my teeth. So here's a song to the show about the